Open today, we have Representative Ackerman with us, so we will open with a hearing on House Bill 3159. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3159 is sponsored by Representative Ackerman. This bill exempts certain contractors from product liability civil actions brought for damages related to asbestos. This bill passed the House with a 60-0 vote.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Greetings from the House Judiciary Committee once again. Products liability involves claims when we have design defects, failure to warn, and failure to instruct with respect to products and substances. In the construction industry, many large projects include many contractors, subcontractors, project managers, suppliers, vendors, architect, and design people. When something goes wrong, it's certainly a litigation technique to join everybody that you possibly can in the case and hope you can settle your way out of it. The problem with that is that there are some people in the chain of commerce in these cases which have no culpability, and the purpose of this act is to show you a niche where House Bill 3159 fits. What that bill does is basically states there's no claim for products liability against a contractor in an asbestos case if the contractor has installed or used the products solely based upon directions made on behalf for or on behalf of the owner of the project. So in other words, the contractor is just merely a conduit for the installation of the asbestos. The contractor should have no other liability under products liability for merely performing those acts. When we were before the House Judiciary Committee on this, we heard from one contractor in Portland who I understand is not going to be here today, so I'm not preempting his testimony. He said that he has been subject of, since about 1997, 15 lawsuits involving asbestos. He was able to back out of 13 of them, and two are still ongoing. But his basic point was, not only did he have to take time and effort to defend these cases, but there were defense costs which had the effect of running up his insurance. He reported that in 1997 his liability insurance was $30,000. In 2005, it was $150,000. So I think what we're saying here is with this very narrowly crafted bill, which only applies to contractors installing asbestos pursuant to directions of the owner, by eliminating them from liability, we will again eliminate frivolous cases, save substantially on defense costs, and hopefully that would have some mitigating effect upon insurance premiums. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
We will now call on Jessica Adamson and David Douthwaite.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and here with me today is David Douthwaite with J.E. Dunn Construction. We're here to talk to you about why we believe this is an important yet narrowly focused bill that will help the construction industry greatly. I'm going to go ahead and let David present testimony on behalf of our members and then follow up with some comments.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Douthwaite. I'm the Vice President of Administration for J.E. Dunn Construction in Portland. We are a large commercial industrial contractor in the Northwest region doing hospitals, offices, public structures. We have had the distinction of being sued twice in the last 3 years on asbestos-related claims. One was for a school that was built in 1948 where a janitor is claiming that he suffers from a mesothelioma, whatever, I'm not sure I can pronounce it properly. That's a long time ago. We were also sued by, in another case, for work done by a Mason subcontractor in the 70s on installing product. In both of these cases, the products installed were specified by the architect and owner and in the specifications and contract that we had to abide by. To let you know a little bit about how we work, for a project, we essentially subcontract 80 to 90% of the work that is done. Smaller independent businesses, subcontractors, provide us with prices or proposals for installing what has been specified by the architect. We take those prices, we put together a proposal or bid to the owner, and the owner selects who they want to have do that work. We are not part of the design process. We are not a part of the product specification process. We merely do what they tell us to do. And the subcontractors that work with us are a number of smaller businesses. For example, on a large project, we may have 30 to 50 subcontractors working for us on that job. On a $40 million job, which is about our average, we may have 35 to 45 subcontractors working for us, doing all kinds of work from insulation, plumbing, mechanical, electrical, toilet partitions, carpeting, sheetrock, exterior, masonry, whatever it takes to do that project. In this case, we are only doing what we are told. One of the things that's interesting is if you get a case like this one that was for a school built in 1948, our first thing, requirement in our business is to go find who was our insurance carrier at that time to notify them of the claim. It's very difficult to find who your insurance carrier was in 1948 or who the broker was so that you can find that broker to put people on notice and what the carriers are. Then we have to go hire a lawyer to see if we can find some basis for defending ourselves or getting out of the case. That takes time. It takes time within our company. It takes cost for the lawyer. And that is an expense that the insurance company bears, and it goes on our loss record. So when we go looking for insurance in the future, they look at the expenses that prior insurers have had to incur because of claims we have had made against us, and it affects our ability to get insurance and the price for getting that insurance. If we have damaged somebody or something because of an accident on our site or safety or things over which we have control, we are happy to be responsible for our actions. But we are not having any control over what is specified by the owner in the products that we build. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Madam Chair, if I may just finish up a few comments. In front of you is a copy of Mr. Robert Burgess with Cascade Acoustics, who is the party that Representative Ackerman identified in his testimony. I wanted to provide you with a copy of his testimony from the House Judiciary Committee. Additionally, we provided you with a copy of some of the cases that were have been filed on this matter. We want to again say that this is an issue for which contractors are caught in a catch-22 situation, and unfortunately it's a catch-22 bound by time. When they undertook these projects so many years ago, they were following the contractual provisions put in front of them. They signed a contract. If they had violated that contract by not installing those products, they would have been sued or been in breach of contract then. Because they did that, and because they followed the instructions of the contract, because they abided by those terms and conditions, they're getting sued today. So it's, for contractors, as you can imagine, it's a very frustrating situation. They are not the decision makers. They're not the manufacturers. This legislation is not designed, and we do not believe it lets manufacturers walk away free and clear, that they are still responsible. This legislation does not exempt them out. So they are still a party that is available to make claims against, as is currently the process today. We're trying to take those in the line of commerce, as Representative Ackerman so eloquently said, take those folks that weren't in the decision-making role out of the line of fire, so to speak. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Peter Preston.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Peter Preston, and I'm a personal injury lawyer practicing in Portland with the firm of Preston, Bunnell & Stone. I'm here on behalf of my clients who have suffered illness and disease from asbestos, and on behalf of Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I am opposed to the bill as written for a number of reasons. First of all, that the bill broadly covers more than what is said to be covered under the bill. I represent a man named John Purcell who worked for the Portland Public Schools and before that as an electrician. He was exposed to products from a company called Owens Corning Fiberglass. Owens Corning Fiberglass was both a contractor and a manufacturer of asbestos-containing materials. This bill would cover a complete exemption for that company. When I represented Mr. Purcell, he was alive, and we went to trial. As a result of that trial, we obtained a verdict of over $4 million. A lot of that was punitive damages against Owens Corning Fiberglass. Because we were able to recover that money, we were able to remit to the school district to reimburse the school district for Mr. Purcell's workers' compensation claim over $300,000. We think that's an important point, that liability is necessary to reimburse the workers' compensation carriers. More importantly, or just as importantly, the bill would protect those contractors who act as sellers of the asbestos-containing materials. What hasn't been mentioned in the previous testimony is that the contractors who install floor tile, acoustic material, plastering material, these are specified in the contracts. One can always move for a modification or a substitution of product that is more safe than the product being specified in the product, in the contract. But what is also happening in these contracts is that the contractors are marking up the product. The definition section of this bill would exempt those contractors who are sellers of the product by their by the reference to the contractor as the meaning given in ORS 701005, which first line is it covers contractors who are sellers. So it's the intent may be to cover just those, quote, innocent contractors that are not selling products, but in practice it would cover those who are selling the products. Finally, or in addition to that, there's a number of other reasons, but I'll just touch on this last one. In 1945, people come up and say, well, we innocently installed this product. Well, in 1945, the Oregon State Board of Health passed an administrative regulation, quite voluminous, which was called Rules and Regulations for the Prevention and Control of Occupational Diseases, passed by the Oregon State Board of Health. And within that, asbestos, amongst a number of other products, were identified as a hazardous product. And it said in construction, the use of this product in its construction has to be, the use of it has to be maintained with release of fibers less than 5 million parts per whatever the specifics were. I've taken numerous depositions. I've talked to many contractors off the record, taken their testimony, and there was never any air monitoring done by any of the contractors, general contractors, specific local contractors, asbestos contractors, plastering contractors. I've never heard of anyone doing any air monitoring before OSHA came into effect in 1972. And this regulation was in effect and applicable from 1945. It was modified in 1947, and it has been changed along the way to accommodate and deal with lesser thresholds of exposure to asbestos, but it's always been in place and always been ignored by the industry. So those are the reasons.
In 1945 and 1946, and that period of time, what methodology was available to determine asbestos contamination in the parts of five parts per million?
Basically the same technology, I mean the same basic technology is available today, but it was available, they were testing in the shipyards, that's how they came up with these standards. The U.S. government was testing in the shipyards in 1936 and 1937 to determine the levels of asbestos exposure in the shipyards. They did it throughout the war, that same technology was available from that time until today.
That technology was readily available to a contractor in 1945.
Absolutely.
Is that it, Senator Whitsitt? Okay, thank you. Do you think, you said that the bill was drafted overly broadly, and I understand there have been efforts made to try to resolve some of these differences and narrow it down. Do you see any way of resolving the differences?
I frankly just had a brief discussion, and as brief as that discussion was, I don't think so, because it has to do with the separation between sellers and non-sellers. I'm fine with non-sellers not being necessarily held liable unless there's some other extraordinary circumstances. But if they're a seller of the product and they marked up their product, then they are covered by the product's liability law and should be. So I don't think there's a compromise, since that was kind of the break point.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3159, and we will open before we do that, we're going to move to Monday, House Bill 2282. There was an omission in the amendment that was being drafted, and we will take that up on Monday. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2297. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2297. is here at the request of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. It expands circumstances under which public indecency is a felony by taking into account out-of-state similar convictions.
Okay, well, committee, I just got informed that I'm going to be losing my entire committee here for a minute. So I think we will take a recess and come back. Well, wait a second. Who do we have on this? Maybe we could just take the testimony on this and then consider what to do then. I think that's what I'll do. I think I will take Brad Berry on 2297, and the rest of the committee is excused. We'll take this as a subcommittee and go from there.
No, Chair Burdick, good afternoon, members of the committee. I am Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. There are two matters actually before you today that we see primarily as housekeeping, and House Bill 2297 is one of those. The law currently provides that if you have a prior conviction for public indecency and you are again arrested and convicted, that it becomes a felony. All this really does is make it clear that the prior conviction can have occurred in any jurisdiction, in any other state, or any other jurisdiction in this state. Just clarifying what was, I think, originally intended by the term prior conviction, but not specifically stated. There are actually several statutes that have come under question about what that means, and most have been corrected, but this one, and the one we'll talk about in a few minutes, both need a little bit of clarification, and that's really all it does. Genuinely, from our perspective, it is a housekeeping measure to ensure that if your prior conviction was in Washington or California or Idaho, that that holds the same kicker to a felony as if you had the prior public indecency conviction in the state of Oregon. It also clarifies that it includes convictions in municipal courts and any other court besides just the circuit court of the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Is this just unique to the public indecency statute, or is this a problem in elsewhere as well?
About the definition of prior convictions, it has popped up elsewhere. There was, Chair Burdick, as I recall, there actually was a proposal to define prior conviction to include all these, to try and cover everything. I'm not sure what happened to that. I know that we spotted this one in particular as we were preparing for the session and brought it forward, as well as the one dealing with DUIs that we'll talk about in a few minutes. And I know other statutes have been fixed or have specifically stated in whatever jurisdiction. And I think there still remain some that are not particularly clear.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions from my lone committee member, the faithful Prozerski? Thank you.
Thank
I apologize
you.
For the subcommittee here. Okay, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2297. No one else has signed up, so we'll close that public hearing. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2361. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill Subcommittee. House Bill 2361 clarifies the revocation requirements when a person has been convicted of misdemeanor driving under the influence of intoxicants for a third or subsequent time. This bill actually came up last session, and the drafter wrote that if the person's privileges will be permanently revoked if they are convicted for a third time. Since the session, last session, repeat offenders present in court on a fourth or subsequent conviction argued the statute required lifetime revocation for third convictions only. It is my understanding that in at least one case that argument was successful, and this just clarifies what I understand to be the initial goal of the legislature, which is third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and beyond would be a lifetime revocation. The amendments on the House side clarified some issues regarding the reapplication for privileges after 10 years.
Thank you. On this one, we'll hear from Brad Berry and Bruce Pratt. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, and member of the committee.
You don't get to say that very often.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Bruce Pratt, member of Crime Victims United. Thanks for this opportunity to speak to House Bill 2361. I will be very brief, as this is a simple bill, and it is simply a refinement of last session's 2885, as counsel has so eloquently stated. It was passed unanimously by both the Senate and the House. If a person is convicted of both felony driving under the influence of intoxicants or misdemeanor DUI for the third or subsequent time in this or any other jurisdiction, that person's privilege to drive is permanently revoked and may not be reinstated for 10 years. There was some confusion, as has already been pointed out, that in reference to the fourth or subsequent times. After an offender has received three misdemeanor DUI convictions, plus possibly a diversion agreement, with the attending evaluation and treatment, that person is considered to be a habitual offender and should not be allowed to drive on our roads. Prior DUI convictions are strong indicators of future disregard for the implied consent law. That person has shown no regard for the lives of others and has not changed his habits, his dangerous habits, through previous sanctions and treatment. Substance abuse treatment is available and is more likely to be accepted by a person who desires help, and DUI is not a prerequisite. This bill simply takes away the privilege of driving from these repeat and dangerous offenders who have shown no regard for the lives of others. Please advance House Bill 2361. Thank you.
Floyd, do you have any Senator Pisanski, any questions? Okay. Mr. Berry.
Thank you. Brad Berry again, Yamhill County District Attorney and Oregon District Attorney's Association. As I mentioned just a minute ago in our other testimony, this too we see as a housekeeping bill, one that when it was originally drafted, I don't think any of us envisioned that it would be interpreted to be limited to just the third conviction. And in fact, my courts have so ruled that that was not the intent, and third means third or subsequent. However, I'm aware of at least two county jurisdictions where, in fact, judges have ruled that it is only the third time that the lifetime revocation applies, thus the request for the change and clarification. This bill also, 2361, also clarifies the statutory counterpart from any other jurisdiction as being a as being one of the prerequisite convictions, you'll note. So it covers the same type of language correction that I mentioned just a few minutes ago. Again, we see it as housekeeping. I think this was the intent of a bill that had tremendous support in the last session.
Thank you. And this is probably an obvious question, but is it being interpreted that the third or subsequent time is any time even before the bill went into effect?
it'll be, Chair Burdick, it will be interesting with this fix. It might, if you had someone who committed a DUI before the effective date of this bill, it might even give more credence to the argument that third meant third. However, this would be, if you commit an offense and are convicted after the effective date of this bill and is your third or subsequent conviction, then you would be subject to the lifetime revocation. So it only looks forward for the conduct.
Well, Senator Pazanski.
Brad, I mean, if you have a person that's been previously convicted for two times,
mm-hmm.
Prior to the bill going into effect, then they commit the offense and they're found guilty, the court would, in fact, look back and say you have two prior convictions that date back, whatever dates those were, prior to the bill being adopted or enacted, and those would count against them. And so you would have that revocation based on those two prior to this bill plus the one that came afterwards, as compared to, I don't think there'd be any retro going back and looking at what's currently in the history and just suspending them for life. I think there's going to be another conviction that causes this to occur.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazanski, that's exactly right. You would have to commit the new offense, which is your third or subsequent DUI, after the effective date of the bill for the lifetime revocation to be imposed. If you have three priors already, let's say I've already been convicted of three times of driving under the influence, this bill would not reach back and then revoke my license for life.
Right,
you have
it won't
to do it again.
Reach back, but you have to do it again. But I can't believe, did I understand you correctly, that some courts have been interpreting it like if you had four in the past and then you get your fifth one after conviction, that they won't do it because it's not your third?
Chair Burdick, that's accurate.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do you have any other questions, nope. Senator Pazanski? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for getting this in quickly.
We have enough people here to act on these, but we'll close the hearing on this bill. Committee, I think we're, now that we've released our counsel to go prepare for tonight's hearing, since I'm the only one left, I think we'll recess until 2:30. My apologies for a very disjointed day. We will come back at 2:30.
Are you going to head over there?
Judiciary Committee will come back from recesses with my abject apologies for those of you who were waiting. I had no idea this was going to last this long. But we are going to have to put everything else on the agenda today over until Monday. And with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.